Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. When President Obama announced his administration's clemency project, advocates for ending mass incarceration were elated. The project was aimed at reducing the number of people in federal prisons who are serving excessive time for nonviolent drug-related offenses, particularly those people who, if they were sentenced today, would receive far less time. So far, the president has granted clemency to just under 100 people. The Justice Department still has nearly 8,000 clemency petitions waiting to be processed. Advocacy organizations who launched the Clemency Project to help inmates apply are disappointed by how few applications have actually been processed. Those who have been disproportionately ignored are women who remain behind bars. There are currently just over 8,000 women in federal prisons for drug offenses. Writing about them is my guest, Victoria Law. She's a freelance journalist. She's the author of Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women. And she recently wrote an article entitled Mothers Serving Long-Term Drug Sentences Call for Clemency. Welcome to Uprising, Victoria.
Thanks for having me, and thank you for covering this.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we've covered this project before, the president's initiative under the Justice Department, as well as the lawyers' efforts in the Clemency Project. But to focus specifically on women, I think, is a really important idea. First of all, I mentioned there were over 8,000 women in federal prisons for drug offenses, drug-related offenses. How does the president's Clemency Project distinguish between those people who are in for drug-related offenses and those who might have extra charges, such as aiding and abetting in these offenses that complicates their clemency applications?
Well, according to the criteria set for Clemency Project 2014, which advocates were hoping would set large numbers of people free, you have to be have served at least 10 years of your sentence in the federal prison system, which knocks out a whole bunch of people who have spent less than 10 years of their 10 years in prison so far. Also, you have to be convicted of a nonviolent drug offense. So I start the article by looking at the case of Michelle West, a African-American mother who was sentenced to two life sentences plus 50 years in prison for a variety of drug charges, including a conspiracy charge and a charge of aiding and abetting a drug-related murder. And although she fits the criteria for Clemency Project 2014 in that she served more than 10 years in prison, she has an exemplary prison record, she's never gotten into trouble, the fact that one of her convictions is for a violent offense for aiding and abetting a drug-related murder, it means that she is not eligible for their criteria. This doesn't mean that she can't apply for clemency on her own, but it does mean that she doesn't have an attorney assigned to her. She would then have to raise the money for her own attorney, which being in prison and making dollars, as in like single digit dollars per day, and having to rely on outside family members to help you raise this money is rather unrealistic for many who might want to have a lawyer help them navigate this kind of process.
So how challenging is it for women, mothers in particular, majority of whom are a large chunk of whom I'm assuming are women of color, to get access to the right kind of legal help for this? Does their gender and race and the income level of their families play a role?
Well, race certainly plays a role. Nearly every woman I profiled is a woman of color. We see, looking at the Bureau of Justice Statistics reports on people in prison, that African Americans are disproportionately incarcerated. In the federal prison system, African American women and Latinas are disproportionately incarcerated, both for drug offenses and for other charges. And we see that oftentimes women are also either the primary heads of household or single heads of household before their arrest, which then means that their families, who might be in a position to help them with legal fees, are suddenly having to shift their resources into taking care of children, taking care of other people that the that their mother that these women had been taken care of before they went to prison. So basically what ends up happening is it also devastates the family, both emotionally, physically, and economically when a mother goes to prison.
You also profile a woman named Cynthia Valdez Shank, who has a heartbreaking story as well. And I think it's so important for us to humanize the stories of these women who are, you know, essentially stuck behind bars unless the president decides to free them. Can you share a little bit of her story with us?
Yeah. So Cynthia Valdez Shanks, in the 1990s, met a man, they fell in love, they moved in together, and one night she came home early from work and she realized that he was dealing crack out of their apartment. They had a fight and then he beat her up. And she said it was the first time he had ever laid his hands on her, and he didn't just hit her, he badly beat her. The next day, he was sorry, it was all roses and I'll never do anything like this again. But basically this began what became a 5-year pattern of him controlling her, abusing her, shrinking her world so that she didn't feel like she had a connection to the outside world, not allowing her to see her family for longer than half an hour at the time, you know, forcing her to quit her job. And in the meantime, he was rising higher and higher on the drug ladder. And then one night, 5 years later, in 2002, he was shot to death at his front door. Cynthia took him to the hospital. The hospital notified the police. She was brought to the precinct for questioning. And then after, I don't know, less than 24 hours, she was released. She was told that there was no charges against her and she was free to go about trying to rebuild her life, which she did. She met a man who was not abusive, not violent, by all accounts, a wonderful man. They got married, they had 2 children. And then 5 years later, the family is woken up at 5 a.m. with police arriving to arrest her on charges of conspiracy to distribute cocaine from being the girlfriend of this man that had been killed.
Five years later, they went after her. 5 years yes. later, after yes. the person who was the victim of horrible domestic violence.
Yes. Wow. Yes. And so she, you know, she went to court. The judge realized that she was not a flight risk. She had a husband. She had small children. Released her on her own recognizance, but the charges were not dropped. So, and at the same time, she realized that she was pregnant with her 3rd child. But thinking, you know, there must be justice. This isn't right. I didn't do anything. Instead of taking a plea bargain or trying to, you know, negotiate a plea bargain, Cynthia decided to go to trial.
As is her right, right? Especially if yes. you think you're innocent, it's the right of people to yes. go to trial. But our legal system is set up in such a way that you either take a plea bargain, have your record stained for the rest of your life, or you risk decades in prison, which is unfortunately what this poor woman got.
Yes. And so when her daughters were still in their, you know, single digits and her youngest was a newborn, she took it to trial and she lost, and she was convicted and sentenced to 15 years in prison.
Wow.
And again, as you pointed out, you know, a woman who survived domestic violence, whose, you know, only connection was through a boyfriend, now dead, who was not involved in distributing cocaine or selling cocaine, and who thought that the justice system would give her that fair trial that supposedly everybody is entitled to. And what's even more heartbreaking is she was sent to a prison. First, she was sent to a prison hours away, and her husband tried to bring the children to visit every month, every other month. And then she was transferred to a prison in Florida, which was, for her family in Michigan, was nearly impossible to get to. And the strain of that broke up her marriage. And fortunately for her, she had family members who were willing to step in and all pool their money. So, you know, her father, her brother, her siblings, you know, everybody is pooling their money in so that that way her children can have a connection with her and can fly from Michigan to Florida to go see their mother. But that's not cheap. That's, you know, 1 adult ticket and 3 children, you know, to fly from Michigan to Florida. Stay overnight in a hotel, rent a car to go to the prison, you know, stay another night perhaps, and then have to fly back. So, I mean, that is a huge undertaking, you know, even for people who are not financially struggling to take a family of four to go from Michigan to Florida. I mean, this is something that people save up for years to be able to take their family to Disney World. You know, imagine trying to do this several times a year so that these three girls can know who mommy is. It's heartbreaking.
Why is she not immediately eligible for clemency, or is she?
She is eligible for clemency. Actually, is she? Under Obama's, yes, she should be eligible for clemency. No, she's not. Sorry. I've written about so many different women
Right.
that sometimes they merge together.
Right.
So I wanted to be sure,
Yeah.
because she has not served 10 years yet. She would not be eligible for clemency under Clemency Project 2014 because she has not spent a full 10 years behind bars. This
So,
doesn't mean that she can't apply for clemency outside of the
right.
project. So she actually has submitted a petition to Obama, not through the Clemency Project, to ask that her sentence be commuted so that way she can get out of prison before her youngest daughter, who she left when she was like a, you know, a tiny little infant, turns 15. You know, so she's.
So this is a story where you have a whole family ripped apart, children growing up without their mother, and that's something that you can never, never get back. And how common are these stories of mothers being separated from their children in such cruel ways in a federal justice system that, you know, is supposed to be fair but is anything but?
It is incredibly common. I mean, if you look at, and it's not just mothers ripped away from their children, but it's also mothers being, or women being unable to be there for other loved ones. So Michelle West, who's serving the double life sentence plus 50 years, you know, was ripped away from her daughter when her daughter was 9 or 10. Her mother, whom she was very close to, raised her daughter and passed away a few years ago. And Michelle West was unable to say goodbye to her mother, was unable to go to the funeral. If she had been allowed to go to the funeral, her family would have had to pay the cost of the security necessary to bring her out of the prison to the funeral. She would have shown up in handcuffs and shackles, which nobody wants, you know, to have their family see that. So there are these, you know, so right there you can see that there's this problem with ripping families apart. There's another woman named Angie Jenkins, whose mother is now 75 years old and had to take on, you know, raising her children when she was arrested and incarcerated. And her mother has only seen her once since she was arrested.
Wow.
And her mother is now 75 years old. And there's always this fear when you're in prison about losing loved ones, you know, like, will you be able to say goodbye to them? Will you be able, well, you know, will you be there when they need you? Or will you be called to a prison counselor's office one day and just told, you know, your parent has died, your mother has died, your husband has died. Angie Jenkins lost her husband while she was in prison. And, you know, she fears losing her mother, as do so many other women who have elderly relatives on the outside that they care about.
You tell also the story in your piece about Alice Johnson, a woman who essentially is now incarcerated because she gave somebody a phone number for where they could give dr get drugs. I just couldn't believe this.
Yes. I mean, again, it's a way in which people who are unable to parlay lots of information into a plea bargain are targeted. So Alice Johnson has never said, "No, I'm innocent. I didn't do it." She acknowledges that she played a very small role in a drug conspiracy. So she was a single mother of five children. The oldest one was in college. She was helping her daughter pay her college-related bills. The youngest one was 14, and she had just lost her job, and the new job that she got was at one third of the pay without any of the healthcare benefits or anything else. It would help support a family of five. So when the opportunity came to make a little bit of money and be able to pay some of these bills, and it didn't involve, to her mind, anything hugely big. It wasn't, you know, here, take these drugs and physically sell them. It was more that, like, when somebody comes to town, they call you and you tell them who to call. That's all it was. And she passed some phone messages, she paid some bills. But then when everybody was arrested, people who had more information than her were able to take their knowledge and turn that into a plea bargain.
Oh,
and they
goodness.
Were able to testify against her. And she, who could only say, well, this was the phone number I was given, you know, didn't have that kind of information to be able to point to other people and say, well, this guy is this or that guy is that. So it's a system in which people who have the least amount of access, similar to the way in which our system says, if you have the least amount of access to money and resources and a good lawyer, it's also if you have the least amount of access to information, you will be the one left holding the bag. You will be the most punished.
And Johnson is also a mother?
Yes. Alice Johnson is a mother of five. Wow. One of her children died before her incarceration. Her youngest surviving child is now in prison. And she says that before she was arrested, he was talking about going to college and what he was going to do with his life. And when she went to prison, he stopped going to high school. She was in prison. She couldn't do anything about this. She was not able to force him to go to high school, you know, to go to school. When the family's house was foreclosed upon, he lived in a car outside the house because he wanted to be in the house where he and his mother had lived last. And now he's in a state prison. And she really blames herself for it. You know, she says, you know, like if this hadn't have happened to me, maybe his life would have been different. So you can see the way in which taking his mother away for life, you know, has seriously impacted this child. Serving a life sentence for this. So she, you know, she acknowledges again and again that, you know, she knows that she did something illegal. She knows that she played a small part, but the fact that she has to serve a life sentence, and in effect, her children are serving a life sentence along with her because it's a life without their mother, is horrible, and something needs to change. Because why are these people serving life sentences or lengthy sentences and having their families ripped apart?
Meanwhile, Victoria, President Obama, and also to a great extent, former Attorney General Eric Holder had begun to acknowledge the great problems of mass incarceration in this country, particularly for people with drug-related offenses. And of course, given that they had control over the federal system, had announced this clemency project. Eric Holder used the kind of catchphrases such as the school to prison pipeline that advocates of ending mass incarceration have been trying to get into the mainstream discourse for years. How do you assess the Obama administration's attempt to rectify what sounds like has been mass injustice on a huge scale done to so many Americans, certainly not by the Obama administration, but they're in power now, and this is an administration that has the power to change it. And it just seems like, given these examples that you're sharing with us, the rules are too strict and not enough is being done.
I think, yes, it is indeed. Rules are, you know, like the criteria is very stringent. It's very narrow. It leaves out people like like Cynthia Shank, who, you know, has supposedly not served enough time to apply for Clemency Project 2014 and have her process be expedited. It leaves out women like Michelle West and who knows how many other women who have a violent conviction in addition to drug offense. And we can't separate out some people and say, well, there was violence in your case, but not in your case, because why are we judging people based on one action that they did or did not do, or might have participated in or might not? Like, it's a dichotomy that then means that this child can say, I will never be able to hug my mother outside. of the prison walls
it's
ever
also,
again.
I mean, even if you do try to, you know, say, well, this person was more violent or committed some or involved in violence, given what you said about our justice system, given the plea bargains that some people have access to and others don't, and the very convoluted system, you know, unless you're examining every single case individually, you really can't tell whether someone deserved a life sentence or 15-year sentence or whatnot.
Yes. And also, I want to point out for listeners who may not be familiar with Michelle West's story that one of the key witnesses against her was the man who had actually done the killing for which she was convicted of aiding and abetting. And he was granted full immunity, meaning that he was not prosecuted, not sent to prison, not threatened with a prison sentence in exchange for testifying against her.
That's outrageous. So, that is just, that should rub every single person listening to this interview the wrong way. And that is just outrageous.
So the fact that she is sitting there with a double life sentence plus 50 years, not able to watch her daughter grow up, not able to take care of her mother when her mother was in her final days, not able to say goodbye to her mother, not able to go to her mother's funeral, and who knows what else down the line as people go through life and they get older and they have, you know, happiness and sorrow and heartbreak, she is going to miss simply because she was not able to parlay information into some sort of deal.
Because she was a snitch, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And she even says, I was not willing to perjure myself, she said, because I was not involved in any sort of drug-related murder. I was not going to say that I did, you know, do something that I didn't do. And I was not going to, you know, I was going to basically, you know, like do what I thought was right. But what she thought was right and what the federal authorities thought were just were two very different things.
So finally, Victoria, what can ordinary people do who are hearing these stories and realizing that even the Clemency Project 2014 announced by the Obama administration is clearly not doing enough to address these horrible injustices? What can they do at this point other than, you know, share your story and the awareness of these women's stories?
I think that sharing the awareness and sharing stories is good. There should also be pressure for the Obama administration to grant more clemencies. I mean, less than 100 is not a lot. You know, he only has this many, you know, so much more time in office. And so there should be a push to say, like, let us speed up this process. Let's look at these people, you know, like, let's drastically reduce the prison population. I mean, Obama has been going around speechifying about how there are too many people in prison for these nonviolent drug offenses. He was the first sitting president to visit a federal prison. So this needs to, you know, there should be a groundswelling of support to say, get people out of prison, you know, don't make them sit there and wait, you know, 10 years on an unjust sentence, you know, get them out of prison now. If you know, let them be able to grow, to watch their children grow up and take care of their parents and take care of their, you know, six significant others and, you know, be a part of the community. Don't make them wait 10 years. Don't make them wait until the next president may or may not extend clemency. And basically, like, put your money where your mouth is.
Well, Victoria, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article from our website, uprisingwithsonali.com, later today. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
My guest is Victoria Law. She's a freelance journalist and author of Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggle of Incarcerated Women. And her article that we've been discussing is entitled Mothers Serving Long-Term Drug Sentences Call for Clemency. It can be found at Truth Out.